Welcome to Transcending Comics, a podcast dedicated to trans representation in comic books, manga, and webtoons, both on panel and behind the scenes. I'm your host, Tommy, and joining me today is someone who's a legend in the world of podcasting and an undeniable icon in the realm of queer superhero comics. Listeners of this show will recognize her work from our first book club episode on Galaxy, the Prettiest Star. She's also finished writing an excellent six-issue Hawk Girl miniseries for DC Comics, and she literally wrote the book on queer superheroes with last year's DC Book of Pride. She's also been making creative writing podcasts like The Voice of Free Planet X, going all the way back to 2005, well before I even knew what a podcast was. Outside of comics and podcasts, she's also worked as a costume designer, a puppeteer, and a circus performer. If any guest of this show has ever been qualified to moonlight as a superhero, it's probably her. With all that said, I'm very excited to welcome today's guest, Jadzia Axelrod.
Hello, thank you for having me. And what a wonderful intro. I don't think I've ever been referred to as a legend and an icon in the same sentence. Amazing. Please introduce me wherever I go.
Will do. Yeah, if you just need a hype gal, I'll be there.
Thank you.
It was nice. I've already done my homework once since, we covered Galaxy as like our third episode. And I was like, whoa, this person did podcasts and puppet work and circus work? Oh my gosh, she's awesome. And so I had all those notes ready to pull from.
Amazing.
But I've got to know, with as much of a storied life as yours, how is working as a comics writer compared to the other jobs I previously mentioned?
It's more fun, honestly. Like, as fun as a lot of those jobs were and are, making puppets is fun. Being in the circus was lots of fun, obviously, but like writing in general and writing comic book superhero comics especially is just the most fun I've ever had.
I'm not sure if I've ever heard you speak elsewhere about your time as a circus performer, and I'd love to at least get a little bit about that. Like,
sure. Well, you know, it was in the early 2000s. Weren't we all in a circus back then?
Mm-hmm.
No, I guess not. I was. It started as something I did in college and kind of grew while I was in college. It petered out after I kept trying to get it going. We had a small group that would perform right before like punk shows. We would be opening acts. Yeah, it was a cool thing. And so I would the ringmaster and I would come out and do a whole thing. Like, I would make it very clear that we weren't doing a magic show, essentially. And I would have a deck of cards there and I'd bring someone up from the audience and I would ask them to take a card and they would take a card. And I was like, all right, memorize that. You got that in your head, put it back in the deck, shuffle the deck. And then I would pluck a card out of the deck, staple it to my forehead and then say, is this your card? And they'd say no, because it never was. And I was like, yeah, it's not a magic show. That was the tenor of our piece. And so like I would do escape art in that and I would juggle odd objects from the audience and I would stick needles in my hands and face. We had one guy who would walk on a ladder of swords. My wife was part of the show and she did contortion acts and we were not married at the time.
Mm.
We had a performer at one point who could get really small and like compress her body into small spaces. So we brought her out in a very tiny wooden box that would open and then she would like slink through tennis rackets and then racquetball rackets and badminton rackets, all this stuff. I had fire breathers. It was a great show. It's hard to keep people doing it. Like, you really have to have a passion for circus work. So if people would do it like once and they're like, this isn't for me. And like, that's fair. But I loved it and I kept trying to do it. And I performed with that show, which was mine. And then I performed with a couple other circuses after graduating college, doing mainly juggling, but also some of the pins and needles stuff. Because that's always, it gets people excited to watch someone stick a needle right in their face. So yeah, and it was fun while it lasted. It's something that kind of petered off once I moved to Philadelphia. I tried to keep it going here, and for some reason or another, like, venues kept canceling or like the show I was a part of just fell apart, and it was like enough that I was like, clearly the gods are speaking and this is not worth keeping up here. But back in my North Carolina days, I did a lot of weird and wonderful sideshow circus stuff.
Now, does that experience with the circus draw you to circus related characters or like a desire to write them? Like,
absolutely. Mm. Absolutely. You know, like I love that. I think it's the circus is such a wonder. I've written circus related characters before. And it's such a wonderful, unique performing art because everything is real and you're doing it in real. And so much of performance is rehearsed and scripted. And I'm not a musician, but I think it's the closest I can get to being a musician in that I'm doing something real and I'm causing an emotional reaction and I'm having a good time with the audience. My brother and sister are musicians, so I don't know why it skipped me, but like, it's not something that I do.
So like, of the major ones, like we got Nightwing, Mr. Miracle, Nightcrawler, like, are there any in particular?
Oh, Nightcrawler for 100%. Nightcrawler has always been my boy. Like, I mean, it seems so silly now to be like, hey, Jadzia, why did you identify with this character who has such trouble with how he looks in the external way and that he's has trouble sometimes with being so furry and looking the way he does. And it's like, oh, obviously, there's a reason your favorite characters are Beast and Nightcrawler and ones like that. So, yeah, childhood dysphoria aside, I've always loved Nightcrawler. I do think he's a great character and I would write him forever. I know Tom Taylor, who's currently writing Nightwing, also has a circus background, so he's got me beat on that one. But should he ever decide to stop doing Nightwing, which he'll probably do until the day he dies, I'm happy to pick up that torch.
As far as the books of the moment go, I know the monthly issues of Hot Girl have just finished coming out, and we've got the trade coming out in June.
Yes.
How about we start with you telling us a bit about your Hot Girl miniseries and like what might appeal to readers that aren't terribly familiar with the character outside of maybe some Justice League or CW show appearances.
Right. Well, that's the beauty of this miniseries, is it's like a starting point. Like, you can pick this up cold. I tried to write it that way. There's a lot of lore that we dig into, both in like Hawk person lore, but also like Kendra Saunders lore, because I'm a huge fan of that character. So there is stuff that I wanted to dig into with her as a character and her history. But I tried to make it so that like you weren't front loaded with it. Like, it wasn't like there was a text page is like, here's everything you need to know going forward. It was like doled out very carefully over the series, kind of held your hand through it. And if you were paying attention, by the time all of that stuff was important in issue 5, you had already picked up everything from context clues and asides and small little bits and pieces.
That was something I really respected about the book, of like how you were able to take a character with as much of a complicated and eventful backstory as Hot Girls, and someone with a history that draws from so many larger books and events, and kind of encapsulate that all in one 6-issue series. And then on top of that, you throw in Superman and Batman and Galaxy and a dragon and like all in 6 issues. So like, how did you manage to be like, okay, we're going to touch on everything about this character and also all my favorite parts of the DC universe in just 6 issues? Like, how do you manage to condense that into so few books?
I mean, I don't know. That was my personal brief, though, was like, I wanted to do that. Like, each issue was going to be like, this is my favorite thing about superhero comics. I'm just going to write that just in case they never let me do this again. Let me get all my little superhero Jones out. So yeah, we're going to fight a giant monster in the city. We're going to team up with Batman and do a monster noir mystery. We're going to go to a gay club in Metropolis because I want there to be one. Like, all of this stuff that's like, it was like a list almost, like mentally. I didn't write it down or anything, but it was a mental list of all the cool things that I've always wanted to do with superhero comic. And I was like, we're going to do all of them. Here we go. And start. And I was really fortunate that I got a character like Kendra Saunders to do that with, because I've loved that character since I first read her way back in the early 2000s, approximately when I stopped being a circus performer, to get the timeline right. And I was reading JSA and really just enjoying that character and her attitude and her like not taking any guff from these old men characters that everyone else was so respectful towards. Love that. So I've always loved that character. And then to have her be like my first like really real superhero floppy comic book job was just a dream come true, because it's a character that I feel like has not gotten the spotlight that she deserves. And it's a character that has been kind of shunted off into supporting roles and like in the background. Like, she always looks really good in the background of group shots, because you can draw her higher above everyone else with big wings. But she hasn't really had a lot of meat, some story meat, that can really dig into there, because she's always been part of an ensemble or a supporting character of Hawkman. And to have her, this be a story about her was very exciting to me as both a writer and a fan. So I came into it with that in mind. That's like, this is going to be, one, everything I love about superhero comics, and two, everything I love about Kendra Saunders. And when I was putting that plot line together, it was clear that I had like essentially a galaxy-shaped hole in the story, because I needed someone who had a contrasting personality, because modern Kendra is very brusque and direct. So a lot of the personality that I loved back in the early 2000s has kind of been sanded off, and I wanted to address that, but it's still, in order for everything to make sense, I still had to include it. So she's got a very brusque, direct personality now, and I needed someone with a more bubbly, fun personality who also had reality or energy or magic-based powers to make my cockamamie superhero plot work, and that was Galaxy. So she was topping the list of supporting characters that I was asking to use. I had backups if they said no, but thankfully, Galaxy the Prettiest Star is a hit, so they were more than happy to include Galaxy in Hot Girl, and she's slotted in quite nicely, I feel like. As for all the other guest stars, the only one that I made, like, I have to do this, was Batman, in part because, like, that's a childhood dream right there, to write a Batman comic, but also one of the things I love most about the only other Hawk Girl series, the Walter Simonson run, was that he established this like peer relationship between Kendra and Batman, which I've always liked. And it was especially at that time when everyone was kind of looking at Kendra as like a sidekick, Batman didn't. And that was a neat thing. And I really liked that. And I wanted to keep that in this sort of like setting up Kendra to a new stage. Let's keep the fact that she and Batman have a respectful professional relationship. All the others were like either editorial suggestions, like with the case with Superman and Power Girl and Black Canary in the first issue, or in the fourth issue with the dragon. Obviously, there's a dragon tracking Metropolis. Some of the super family needs to be there. And I was given a list of who was not being in a book that month. And so I was like, great, I will take the lesbian. We are absolutely using Steel. And let's throw Supergirl in there for fun.
On those Batman elements, getting to incorporate and expand on that relationship.
Yeah.
I was curious about the choice of the Court of Owls
as yes.
the villains for the book. So of all the Batman rogues gallery, why the Court of Owls for this?
Hawks versus Owls, man. Hawks versus Owls.
Yeah, okay, that checks out. That's
yeah, because like dynamic. When I was trying to think of villains for this book, I was like, well, what are the natural predators to hawks? Turns out none, because they're alpha predators. But there's a lot of other similar alpha predators that compete for resources. One of them is owls. So it's like, we got to have the Court of Owls in here. And the other is foxes. So when I was coming up with a new villain with Vulpecula, I wanted her to be fox-based, essentially, and have that trickster fox spirit kind of element. So yeah, it was really just down to hawks versus owls, which just seemed a no-brainer. If I get more Hawk Girl stories, we're going to see more Hawk Court of Owls in there, because that conflict is just really interesting to me.
Now, another central aspect of the book and kind of playing on that trickster element was the nature of folklore in the story. And I know you've mentioned elsewhere how much like you see folklore in modern comics, and characters like Superman and Wonder Woman almost act more like folklore figures in relation to the culture now. I'd love to know, like, if others pick up on these same themes and treat the characters you've worked on in a similar way, how do you hope that Galaxy and Hawk Girl get used in this manner in the future?
Oh, that's an interesting thing. I mean, I have had a little window into that, because Galaxy is a part of Nicole Maine's upcoming Dreamer book, Bad Dream. And so I have seen how someone else both sees Galaxy and uses Galaxy. And that has been wild. Thankfully, Nicole is a wonderful writer with an amazing sense of character. So it wasn't like I looked at what she had done and was like, oh, no, this is all wrong. Like, all of it was right. Everybody sounded right, because the same things that make Nicole such a great actor, the same things that make her such a great writer, just a really great understanding of character from the ground up. So, I mean, I would hope that they, one, are as good as Nicole is. So let's start there.
Mm-hmm.
No one of less quality than Nicole should be doing this. But also that there's the same thing that I approach this character with is that respect and fondness for what has come before. Like, we talked a little bit about the Walt Simonson stuff, and huge fan of the Geoff Johns JSA and then early Hawkman that really dug into this character and made her what she is. Like, I wanted to come to that with a lot of respect, and because I do like those stories. I do think they're good stories. Like, it was weird to read them again, looking at them from Kendra's perspective, which I had not done originally, and to see the ways in which they are. It's a little strange from her perspective. Like, it makes sense from the perspective that it's being shown, usually from the men in her life. But if you look at it from her perspective, it's like, this is weird. But I still like those stories, and I still think there's a lot to enjoy about them. So that's all I would want. It's just like a respect and a love that I brought to the character. I'm not the first person to write Hot Girl, and I won't be the last, one hopes. But I do hope that people take what I've done and what I've added and respect that and use it going forward. It's weirder with Galaxy because there was nobody before me with Galaxy. Mm-hmm. And so putting her in the DC universe, like having her be a part of that, means that at some point other people are going to use her and tell stories with her. And I just hope that they, again, respect what's come before and are fun and are good stories.
On Galaxy, I mean, this being a trans comics podcast and her being a trans superhero, like, I'd love to get into her a bit more.
By all means.
And yeah, so in Hot Girl, you reveal that Galaxy has identified as trans since before even coming to Earth.
Mm.
I'm curious if that's always been something in her backstory that you've had in mind, or if this was something that was added later to confirm that, like, she's actually trans in a literal sense and not just a very trans-like allegory with alien-associated identities.
Right. Well, you have to understand that I did not think there was going to be more than one Galaxy appearance.
Mm.
Like, I thought I was very fortunate to have gotten Galaxy the Prettiest Star picked up. Like, I did not think this was going to be something that was going to fly off the shelves. And I did not think it was a character I was going to be writing later. I thought, this is my one DC book. Well, I did what I wanted to do. Here we go. So a lot of the larger concerns about her and her story, I honestly didn't think about. Like, we leave her gender assigned at birth nebulous on purpose, right? Like, because that's not what the story is about. Like, it's not about who she was on Sandy. It's about who she is on Earth. But when we moved her to Hawkgirl, now she's a part of the DC universe. And so a lot of the stuff that was like kind of airy fairy metaphor stuff that we could get away with in the graphic novel now had to be concrete. Like, we had to list exactly what her powers did. We had to show her gender assigned at birth and her having a different identity than that back in Sandy to show who she is and to make her, I guess, textually trans. I always thought of her as textually trans, but I know some people didn't when reading the book, and I get that. But there was this need to do that for exactly what we talked about a moment ago, which is like someone else is going to take this character and they're going to write something and they're allowed because she's part of a shared universe. So I need to make sure that all the details are canon and correct. And so one of those things is like listing exactly what her power set is. Another is showing her gender identity. Another is explicitly having her say that she's a lesbian, because we never say that in Galaxy the Prettiest Star. We don't have to, because that's, again, that sort of identity claiming is not in a book about identity claiming. That sort of identity claiming is not what the book is about. So it was an interesting thing to do that, and to have to kind of make concrete a lot of the stuff that we've left unfocused, because that with the graphic novel, we had a very tight focus of what we wanted to do. And with putting her in that bigger universe, we need to allow all of that other stuff to become crisp and clear so that other people could build upon it.
And I know you've thrown a lot out there about Galaxy's backstory in Hawkgirl and the years between her own graphic novel and her appearances in Hawkgirl. And I know you've mentioned that, like, you have like 4 years of stories that you have in your mind that you pull from to inform how you write the character and her supporting characters now.
Yeah, I had to plot all that out in my head in order to write her at 22. Because the decision, this wasn't my decision. This was an editorial thing where they're like, we don't like the idea of a teenage galaxy. We like the idea of a young adult galaxy. And therefore, she and Hawk Girl are peers. We like that dynamic. And I was like, that does sound like a fun dynamic. Mm-hmm. I'm down. Now I just have to figure out what she's been doing in the 6 years in between. So I did plot all that out.
So do you imagine, like, if you ever get the chance to explore those years, would you prefer to do it in the form of, like, more graphic novels in the same format as Galaxy's first one? Or would you rather do it as, like, an ongoing monthly series?
I would like her stuff, her teenage stuff, to continue to be graphic novels. That feels right. Like, if we could do a series of graphic novels that kind of cover the ground in between Galaxy, the Prettiest Star, and Hawk Girl, and then Hawk Girl is her first, like, superhero
mm-hmm.
statement, would be great. But I'd also, if we do get a Galaxy ongoing, which would be nuts, that would be awesome. Not impossible, because the book is a hit. It could happen. If I do get a chance to write that, I would love to do it, but I would want it to be her in her early 20s doing superhero things, right? Because mm-hmm. that would be the fun of that.
And I noticed that, like, distinction between the superhero years and her teen years. And when the graphic novel was all we had, I kind of enjoyed the fact that, like, all of Galaxy's conflicts and victories are personal ones, like, that there isn't any kind of external threat that's introduced. And even at that, like, every win is something, like, that's very much internal to her. It's not even, like, defeating the xenophobic school or, like, changing her family's minds necessarily. And I'd really love to know, like, what went into establishing those conflicts and deciding, like, okay, this might be a sci-fi or superhero book, but this is going to be closer to the actual problems that modern trans teens face.
Yeah, that was something that I really wanted to do and wanted the focus of. And I did think that I had to have, like, a fight at the end. So the original plot had, like, a tacked-on fight. Like, Lobo showed up, too. And, like, Galaxy fought him and all this stuff. And it was, thankfully, the wisdom of my editor, Michelle Wells, who was like, this is not the ending you want. I can tell that. This is not the ending you want. And I was like, yeah, it isn't. And the reality was that I'd been afraid of the ending that I wanted. Like, I knew that was going to be hard emotionally to write, but it was the right thing to do. And so the second draft of the outline has the ending that's in the book where, you know, she goes to homecoming and they don't let her in. And it's still a moment of triumph for her because she realizes that she doesn't need the homecoming that she thought she wanted. And that was very powerful. It was very difficult to write because of that. But it was the right choice. And I'm glad I did that. And to have this sort of, like, superhero story, but the person she saves is herself, was really important. And that was kind of the goal with that whole graphic novel. If we do more graphic novels, it might be a little bit different. Who knows? Each book is its own thing.
Now, I'd be curious if you could speak to the character of Taylor's brother. Like,
yeah.
I remember on that first read thinking that this character would make for the perfect villain or antagonist for Galaxy. And, like, in a way I've not seen done in other trans narratives because Galaxy's transition literally prevents him from, like, turning back to his natural form, where he's stuck as a human because Galaxy transitioned.
Right. And
do you imagine, like, if we revisit those early years of Galaxy, like, would you likely use him as an antagonistic force, or do you imagine they'd be able to work that out interpersonally?
No, because his problem is that he's her cover, right? Mm-hmm. And so the moment that she doesn't need a cover anymore because she's out, he feels relieved. And, like, you can see his character change from that moment on, because his problem is like, I'm not a person anymore because I have to protect you. And then when it's like, she is no longer in hiding, he then is free to be his own person. So I don't think he would be an antagonist. If he shows up in any future books, I think he would be a much friendlier person. Because, like, he's had a hard time of it. Like, this is the problem with me writing books, is, like, I fall in love with all of the characters. And, like, they all have my sympathy. So, like, even Carl, who is such a jerk, like, you understand why he's a jerk, right? He's been in this situation he didn't ask for. He has to do these things, not even for himself, but for someone else. And he has his own demons that he's fighting and doesn't have a release for. And so I would love to use him in future books and to kind of show him get that release that he's always been looking for.
Mm-hmm.
But we see a little bit of that in The Prettiest Star, where, you know, once Taylor looks the way she does, like, there is some relief that falls off his shoulders. And that's why in the end, he's able to be like, she's not someone we can keep in a cage, right? Even though we tried, that's over now. And we need to accept that and move on. And she's beautiful. Like, that's something that he's only able to do because he is no longer essentially the jailer. And because he's not the jailer anymore, he doesn't have to keep her in jail.
I feel like that plays into one of the things I like most about your comics, and that's the way you explore the human side of these very supernatural sci-fi situations. And like, even taking that more to the superheroes themselves, like, I've noticed you have a really good tendency to just expand on the world in massive and thought-provoking ways with just a single line. Like, what stuck out to me was Kat in Galaxy mentioning how, like, seeing Superman isn't like a good or exciting thing, but like a sign that something terrible has happened. And I'd love to know where this sentiment comes from within you as a writer, and just like as something you look to explore in your comics.
Yeah, I mean, that's what excites me as a writer, is to be like, what if this was real? Like, what if these were human beings who had to deal with this in a way that's like, kind of, there's lip service given to, but isn't really explored. And like, if you are a normal person in a world of superheroes, it's cool to see a superhero streak across the sky, but it's like an ambulance that's gone by, right? Like, that means that someone's in trouble. That means something bad has happened. If you see a superhero coming toward you, that means something bad has happened to you, because they're coming to save you from something that you cannot get out of yourself. Like, that's terrifying.
Mm.
That's existentially terrifying, right? Like, we position superheroes as these symbols of hope, which they are, but also to really be in that world is like, has got to be like terrifying. And that's always been like, again, that's something that I find really appealing. Like, what does it mean to be a real person in this world? Where does Hawk Girl sleep when she's not at the Justice League? How does she pay for that apartment? What is Galaxy doing when she's not being a superhero? What is Kat doing? Like, how does being in a city of superheroes change the way you interact with people? There is a subplot that sadly was cut in Hot Girl because I was trying to do too much. But there was a subplot, which was Kat's subplot, which was her interacting with people in Metropolis. And we see what it means to be a normal person in a world, and specifically a city, that has so many superheroes in it. That's wonderful, and some that's terrifying. And like, that push and pull is what makes, I think, superhero stories so interesting, because it's so fun and colorful and wonderful and dynamic and hopeful until it isn't. And then the world is about to end. And then like, that push and pull is like, I never get enough.
I feel like that's something both Marvel and DC have left woefully unexplored. Like, just an average person's life in any major city in these universes, I feel like, is just full of story potential. Like, I mean, in Marvel, just from the events like Spider-Man and Avengers stuff, like, a normal person has probably experienced having spider powers for like a week and getting turned into a lizard and finding out a loved one is actually a Skrull and like faced the end of reality and accepting that several times. And I feel like that's just that base level human perspective of someone that's not directly involved in superheroes is something that's just as interesting as any of the superhero comics out there. And I'd love to see that explored more outside of just plain superhero titles.
Yeah. Dwayne McDuffie, I want to say, wrote a great series called Damage Control in the 80s. And it was a Marvel book. And the idea was, these were the people who were there to take care of the mess that superhero battles left. So they're the ones who had to figure out a way to store the giant robot that's now taking over part of the of Manhattan. They had to rebuild things, like, and what was the cost of that? And it was such a brilliant series, one of my favorites. And so, yeah, that sort of perspective of like, now that the superheroes have done their thing, now what do we do? Is just catnip to me. So yeah, I've loved that series, and I'm not surprised that now, getting a chance to do my own stories, I get to pulled from that perspective.
Now, I've also noticed you incorporate music quite a bit in your comics, and Galaxy in particular, pulling from like David Bowie's Aladdin Sane album and Ziggy Stardust. Like, if I see a song title as a chapter title, I'm going to put that on and like see how well it matches. And sure enough, like I felt like that and the following songs on their albums were a good fit for the vibe of the book. And I'm curious if that's something that like you put a lot of intention to, or if that's just happy byproduct of like having a writing playlist, or where that musicality in your comics comes from.
All right. I think we need to make clear everything in these books I put too much thought into. All right. Like, I am one of those writers who thinks about this stuff too much and in too great a detail and making sure all the little pieces fit, because that's just who I am. So yeah, I thought about it too much. I've wrestled over which David Bowie song to put in there. With Galaxy, when you write a book about a teenager, you have to then like think about, well, what was I into as a teenager? Who was I like as a teenager? To kind of get that teenage mindset back. And one of the things that I was into as a teenager was 70s era David Bowie. A friend in art class gave me a mixtape and I was like, this is amazing. Because I had only heard like his 80s stuff, which is wildly different. And to have that as a queer, definitely not out trans teenager, and to have this sort of like very gay and very kind of gender nebulous rock and roll was just, and to have it be like something that happened long before you were born. That was the other wild bit. It was like, this was old and it was doing all this stuff. It felt timeless. It felt like something from another world, literally, because it was just so alien to me. And I fell in love with it. So when I was thinking about the things that I liked as a teenager that I would put into the character of Galaxy, having her be a huge fan of 70s era David Bowie just made sense. It fit a lot of the themes of the book and it fit a lot of the themes of the character. So to have her be into that and then to have the chapter headings with the different song titles just made a lot. And of course, like it's named after a David Bowie song. Mm-hmm. So, and all of that is 70s era. Like if we get more books, maybe we'll do 80s era David Bowie songs or 90s, 2000 eras. I mean, the dream is like we get a gazillion Galaxy graphic novels that we can do this with. But in any case, with that, having those David Bowie song things and to also have like music and dance be an integral part of her character and how she expresses joy just like was of a piece, right? So then when we move that character to Hawk Girl, there has to be a similar sequence, right? There has to be a sequence with dance and music and audio. Mm-hmm. And it seemed weird to do it with like to bring David Bowie back for that because David Bowie was such a Galaxy as a teenager thing, and we listen to more music as we get older, so it made sense to have her be more into modern stuff. So it's like, who is the modern band she's listening to now at 22? Well, it has to be Muna. It's got to be a bunch of queer women singing about just great dance moves, great dance songs, great dance grooves. That's what I was trying to say, not moves. So that has to be, so like, yeah, she's going to go to the gay club in Metropolis. They're going to play Muna and she's going to get very excited. And then the Boy Genius album came out earlier last year when I was writing this book, and they have that line in the song Not Strong Enough where they just scream always an angel, never a god over and over again. And I was like, that is the theme of Hawk Girl. So we have to include a reference to that because it's like, it's too good. It's too right there. So yeah, so she says a Hot Girl says a Boy Genius lyric in issue 6. Canonically, Galaxy loaned her the album. Huh? But you don't need to know that to get the point. Because Kendra is not someone who's going to search out pop music at this point in her life. But maybe she will now that Galaxy is her best friend. Because music is really important to Galaxy. And we may see that if we get more stuff because her powers keep her from interacting with screens for any long period of time. Because it's hard to pay attention to an image on a screen when you can see the individual light waves going and all that stuff.
So this right? is how you write a millennial that's not a TikToker.
Exactly. Yeah. So she's not a screen person, but she gets into music. Like that's a different form of energy that she can get behind and enjoy. That everything else is too much.
Would that make her more of like a vinyl girl then? Because
she probably is a vinyl girl.
That was what got me on Bowie. Like I was 25 and with a friend, and they put on Hunky Dory on vinyl, and like I'd never like Bowie was the other guy on Under Pressure for me to up to that point, because I was a big Queen kid,
and sure,
I never got the appeal.
No, that makes vinyl, sense.
But like then in that room, like I somehow, like the magic of vinyl and Hunky Dory used together, I'm like, I get both of these now. Bowie is awesome. And like I started a vinyl collection from there, starting with tracking down Hunky Dory.
I used to have a record player and I don't anymore, but I still have some records that I've kept. And every now and then I think I should get a record player again and I should start getting records. There's just something about the tactile thing of like putting a record down and putting the needle down and being able to watch the needle move up and down as it hits those grooves is something that fascinated me as a kid. And like, I think still is part of the experience.
Other references I'd be remiss not to mention on this podcast. I know you make several allusions to Whipping Girl.
Yes.
And Julia Serrano. And I'd love to know about the influence of that on the book and your relationship to that, since that was a foundational text for me as a trans person. Like someone made me read that and I'm so glad they did.
I'm going to disappoint you because it's not a huge one, unlike the Bowie thing. It's more of the fact that it was the right title, and that Kendra, you know, like this idea of a whipping boy, of someone who gets punished so that someone else can get away, is in there. And like to have her be a whipping girl instead of a whipping boy, obviously she's a girl. But again, it was that like not nudge, nudge, wink, wink to Julia Serrano and the book. I wish it was deeper than that. I really wish, but it's not. I'm sorry.
Oof. No, can't win them all. But before we wrap up, I do want to make sure to touch on your podcasting career, since I mean, I don't understand how someone gets into podcasting in 2005. Like, how did you find your way to this medium and like using it as a way to narratively tell stories?
Yeah, I mean, earlier adopters got to early adopt, I guess. Like, it was something my friends were into, and I was fascinated by it. Like, I had done college radio, so, and I have a background in performance. We've talked about that. So the idea of, I understood the power of the spoken voice, and I was interested in, like, the medium of podcasting and having a radio show that's not a radio show. And I had just been a part of 365 Tomorrows, which was a writing collective where we put out pieces of flash fiction, science fiction stories every day for a year. And so I had all these stories that I really liked, but weren't really something that we could do more with. But I could do audio of them, and I could play around with the sound of that, with sound effects, with music, with different voice actors. And that was a lot of fun. And yeah, it was a weird time to be in podcasting in 2005, because like all you had to do to get an audience then was to be on like one directory, because there are so few podcasts you could fit them on one webpage. If you were on Podcast Pickle, you got an audience because that's where people looked. And then, you know, and that was only for a couple of years, and then it exploded, and then there was no way to keep up with all the podcasts that were happening. But in those early days, it was wild. Yeah, it was really interesting to be a part of the podcasting community at that time. Because like we were, the first wave was like a whole bunch of audio enthusiasts, really. And like people who were radio people, or people who were like interested in the technology and playing with it. And then after that was the second wave, which I was a part of, which was more about like, now that we have this technology, now that it's here, now people have done this, what can we do with it? How can we stretch it? What kind of stories can we tell and utilize with it? What can we do since we're not making a radio show, and we're not, it doesn't have to be a certain length. It doesn't have to be a certain format. It doesn't have to be about, it doesn't have to just be talk radio that you download. It could be something else. And that was a really cool thing to be a part of. And I really liked that. And I loved how experimental some of the people got. And it was just a really nice community to be a part of back then.
How would you say all those years of writing for narrative story podcasts have shaped the way that you go about writing comics now?
Oh, definitely has. I mean, it's something that I've always, like I used to want to be a playwright. So I read a lot of plays. I watched a lot of plays. I listened to a lot of radio plays and things recorded. And so like the idea of telling a story entirely through dialogue is something that I've always loved and enjoyed. And it's second nature now to be like, how do we tell this story through dialogue? Well, of course, they just talk about it. And it feels weird to say I've been training my whole life for this, but I really have in a lot of different ways. And here I am.
Now, I have to ask on behalf of a friend here who they're kind of going the opposite route of you. They started with writing their own comic scripts. He's the person who kind of introduced me to both podcasting and comic writing. And he's now moving to audio dramas, at first with directly adapting published comics into them and as practiced, and now kind of more original audio drama work. And I'd love if I could get some advice for him based on your experience going the opposite direction of like how he might be able to use that comic writing experience in the realm of audio drama.
I mean, there's such different mediums because you can draw a lot more as an audio drama, right? Like you don't want to have too many words on a page in a comic book. And I know I pushed that as far as probably it should be pushed in some of the bits of Hot Girl where we just had to get all this information in. But with an audio thing, you can have someone just keep talking as long as what they say is interesting and as long as the performer is engaging, right? So it's very different. You also like have everything in front of you with a comic, right? Like the illustration is there. You don't have to say, and then he lifted something very heavy. Whereas in an audio drama, you have to be like, well, Joe, I don't know if you can lift that. It looks really heavy. Oh, no, I got it. So like there's limitations to both mediums. You have a lot more control of time in an audio drama. So that's a lot of fun. You can kind of control time a little bit in comics, but not people are going to read as fast or as slow as they're going to. Like you can force their hand a little bit by increasing panels and drawing things out over a page turn. But as far as like really controlling the sense of time, you can't beat an audio drama for that because like that's all there is just people locked in listening. And it's also strange, right? Because like comics, there is no sound. Like you can have a sound effect. You can have people talking. You can do all these things to kind of mimic it. But if there's any sound at all, it's going to be in the reader's head. And it could be there. It could not be there. And you have no control over that. Whereas an audio medium, you have so much control, especially of the sound, because that's all it is. I don't know, man. They're so different. They're so different. I mean, the biggest thing is like you have to be entertaining either way. Like at the end of the day, you need to do what the medium does best. You need to show bodies in motion, which is what superhero comics do amazingly well. Or in the audio, you need to show ideas in motion. And like one of those. I don't know. It's such a weird thing to think about. Yeah. It's like you have to figure out what each one does best and lean into that. And yeah, they're very different. They're so different. The more I think about it, the more I'm struck by how different they are, which is funny because like in writing them, it's like you think basically the same. You're writing in sound effects, you're writing in dialogue, you're doing essentially the same, but they are wildly different. And I guess that's just to respect those differences and revel in them.
Now, do you have any intention of returning to the world of podcasting yourself?
So much work. It's so much work. And it's like, the reason I stopped is because I had a child and like, she is a lot of work and I love her to death, but it's like audio writing and recording and editing is so much work. And I just don't have the time to do it. Mm-hmm. And if I have that spare time, then it has to go for things that people are going to pay me for, which is like, you know, I love podcasting and I would like to go back to it. Because we left a lot of stuff dangling with the voice of Free Planet X. And like, I have ways to tie up all those threads. I promise you, everybody who have listened to that show and love it and want to know what happens next. I do know what happens next. I have it all planned out. But like, it's hard to justify that time before no money, essentially. And that's really what it comes down to. And especially with the comics having gotten into so many people's hands and been so affecting to people and really helping them in ways that the podcast, as fun as it was, never did. It's really feels like I should keep doing more of that.
As for future comics, what, if anything, can you tell us about upcoming projects? I guess both in comics and elsewhere.
I know. I wish I could. There is stuff coming up from DC that you will see probably not this year, No, definitely not this year. Probably next year. It takes a long time to draw these books. And like, I would rather the artists take their time and do their best possible job than rush them. So like, that's part and parcel with everything. But yeah, you'll see it hopefully next year, maybe the year after. Either way, it'll be worth it. So be patient for that. And there's a couple of things that are like in pitch stage and that may turn into real books, but that's going to be another few years again. So nothing on the horizon that I can talk about, but know that there's more stuff coming. Better than nothing. But okay. Yeah, there's, if you liked Galaxy the Pretty Star and you liked Hawk Girl, you're going to love what's coming. But more than that, I can't say.
Okay. Now, I always do like to close with one kind of wild card question tailored to the guest. And for this, since Galaxy takes such heavy inspiration from Aladdin Sane and Ziggy Stardust, if you were to write a comic or a story of any kind about any character around Bowie's Hunky Dory albums, what kind of story would
it be? Life on Mars is on Hunky Dory, right? Yeah, that's the one.
Yeah.
Like, because that's one, just a killer song. And also, like, there's a narrative in there that you could build upon. So, yeah, it would absolutely be, is there life on Mars? And it would absolutely evoke that song in a lot of different ways. It would be very sad, but it's a god-awful sad affair.
Would we be doing, like, a literal story on Mars, or more of the, like, I always took it as a more grounded story of, like, one poor girl that's, like, seeing her future slip by and wondering or still considering all the things that used to inspire her growing up.
Yeah, I think we can use Mars as like a sort of mythological touchstone kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And the wondering of the possibilities of the future that either are past or at the very least unanswered. Yeah.
If we're going real literal, it could be Galaxy meets Martian Girl from Young Justice.
I love Miss Martian. I would love to have Galaxy Miss Martian have a meetup. That'd be great.
But Jadzia, it's been absolutely wonderful having you on the show.
Oh, it's been a delight.
Yeah. If our listeners want to follow your work, where can they find you online?
Don't follow me.
Okay. Don't follow her.
No, it's fine. I'm really burnt out on social media in general.
Mm.
So, but I'm still there. So you might as well.
Mm-hmm.
I'm Planet X on just about everything worth looking for. So if you go to Twitter, it's on there. Blue Sky, Blue Ski, however you want to look at it. That's Planet X. Instagram is Planet X. The website is jadziaaxelrod.com, which has links to other stuff. The newsletter, I need to update that because there's no tiny letter anymore, but it's being moved to somewhere else. So,
gotcha.
And that will be on the website and on the social medias when it is moved. Yeah. So just Planet X is a good call if you're looking for me anywhere, but I'm on these places. Find me. Look at my outfits and the food that I cook. It'll on Instagram. It'll be great.
Yeah, she's a lot of fun, folks.
I'm a delight.
Yeah, especially mid book, like that really enhanced the hot girl experience, and that's what got me into Muna. By the way, like I hadn't heard them before, and I'm so glad you said their name first because that's still my only touchstone. So I'm like, I don't want to be asking about Mune and then look
right.
like an idiot.
I mean, that's just my guess. I think it's pronounced Muna. It may be pronounced Muna. Who knows? The point is, they're great, and go listen to them.
All right. Well, if the listeners at home have requests or recommendations for comics or creators you'd like us to cover in the future, you can send them our way on social media. You can find us on the Transcending Comics Instagram and Facebook page, on Twitter is at Transcend Comics, or email us at transcendingcomics@gmail.com. We'd like to thank you again for giving our podcast a chance, and give a special shout out to Rayday Parade for designing our logo. Our intro and outro music this week is A Little Soul and You've Been Starring by Carlson. Check out more of his music on carlson.com. Join us again next time as we continue transcending boundaries and exploring the colorful world of trans, non-binary, and genderqueer representation in comic books of all kinds. As the curtains fall on this episode of Transcending Comics, remember that comics have the power to inspire change in countless worlds, including our own. Keep reading, keep writing, and keep transcending.